Good morning. We need to announce a schedule change this morning. This morning's topic was to have been spiritual traditions that affirm lesbian and gay lives. And we have changed that topic to be violence in lesbian and gay lives. Because it's an area that I think has been lacking in our discussion and that we need to take a closer look at. We will reference spiritual traditions that affirm lesbian and gay lives on Thursday. That is, we'll give you resources which will help you in learning about traditions that affirm lesbian and gay lives. But on Thursday, we're going to talk about when love creates a family as our main theme. So that topic will be the same on Thursday. So today, it's violence in lesbian and gay lives. And Thursday, it will be when love creates a family. And we're going to look at today violence in society and the church's participation in that violence. And Thursday, we're going to look at the church's participation in healing as well. So I just want to open today's topic with a little introduction to how we communicate. And some of you may have heard this before, but bear with me if you have. Research has shown that about 10% of our communication happens as a result of the words that we choose. 10% as a result of the words that we choose. 35% of our communication results from the tone of voice that we use. And 55% of our communication results from our non-verbal language, our body language, how we're sitting or standing, how we're holding ourselves, the gestures that we use, are 55% of our total communication. Have you ever had a situation where, you know, you're telling a friend or a family member, well, you know, I was talking with so-and-so and all I said was that, you know, I just didn't think that she should have acted that way the other day when the family got together at the dinner table, you know, and she just, you know, she reacted so badly. And you have this, you know, you're telling the friend, but you're telling the friend in a normal tone of voice, and the friend is sort of going, oh yeah, it seems like an overreaction to me. But what you're leaving out is the tone that you used at the time. For example, I have here, I tried to pick the most innocuous passage I could find. Here is 10%. One of the most encouraging business trends is the increasing sensitivity of some consumer products companies to the environmental impacts of their products. Green products have been on the market for years in Europe and are just now being introduced in Canada and the US. One of the most encouraging business trends is the increasing sensitivity of some consumer products companies and the environmental impacts of their products. Green products have been on the market for years in Europe and are just now being introduced in Canada. Well, what did you get from that experience? Obviously, you didn't get the words that I chose to use. You got my tone and you got my gestures. So we need to look at our communication and how people experience our communication. Not only what we say, but how what we say functions for other people. And that will introduce us, hopefully, to our topic today, which is violence in lesbian and gay lives. And we decided that we wanted to share with you some stories of our own experience of violence in lesbian and gay lives, the lives of those near us and our own lives as well. And give you a chance to respond to that and talk some more about our society as a society of a lot of violence. One of the things that I think that we have gotten enculturated to in the United States is the normalization of violence. If you turn on the television set, it will not take you more than 15 minutes to find instances of violence. Usually, violence against women or violence against other oppressed groups. But it doesn't take, you know, more than 15 minutes of primetime TV to give us a dozen episodes of violence. What's the statistic now on a good cop show? You have to have about 6 instances of violence in a half an hour to make it entertaining? See, we've normalized violence, and we've normalized it by making violence entertaining. That it's one of the ways we get a cultural thrill. And we have also wedded sex and violence for an increased thrill. And that's a very dangerous development in our country. Well, enough said. I want to turn it over now to my colleagues, and we'll be sharing some stories together.
One of the I'm going to share a story about physical violence that happened to me a couple of years ago, and I share this because I think lots of times violence is shocking because it's so startling, it's so surprising, it comes out of nowhere, it happens to anyone, it happens at unexpected moments. I didn't believe that violence was a real reality, I think, for a lot of people before this experience. And after this experience, let me share the experience, and then I'll talk about it. A year ago, I was preparing to go I had been invited to be a chaplain on a cruise boat. And I was preparing the night before I was leaving and packing my clothes and getting ready, and discovered that I had failed to go to the bank and get money to bring with me on the boat. And so I decided I would walk to the ATM and pull out $200 or whatever and for my trip. I was leaving the next morning. I live in a part of San Francisco which is I lived in a part of San Francisco which was at between the Castro District and the Mission District. It was a very heavily gay Hispanic area. And there was kind of conflict sometimes between those communities, but it was never conflict that I had witnessed or that I had been a part of. I choose to live in the gay ghetto because it's very empowering for me. I do not have to be apologetic about my life. I don't have to censor myself at all in the area in which I live. It's a difficult area, though, because it also attracts persons who are looking to do trouble or to do harm. And that particular evening, it was about 10 o'clock, I had finished ironing my shirts, and I decided that I would walk 6 blocks up to the ATM at the corner of Market and Noe. I don't know how many of you know of San Francisco. Very well-lit, very populated area, even at 10 o'clock. Lots of traffic, lots of people. And as I was walking down a fairly main street where there were lots of cars, walking along, minding my own business, all of a sudden I was aware that there was a group of 5 guys walking behind me. And I was a bit concerned, so I walked a little bit faster. And I heard then things like faggot and queer and some shuffling in this group behind me. And I decided that this was not a good situation and that I ought to walk even faster. As I did that, I turned around and looked at this group, and the group dispersed. And these men kind of fanned out behind me on the street as I was walking down, and I decided that this was not only a bad situation, this was a horrible situation, and I should not walk on the sidewalk where I was walking, but I ought to walk in the middle of the street, kind of in the traffic, as the traffic was going both ways, because that would obviously deter whatever it was that was going to happen. As I moved into the street, the guy started running, and I started running, and started yelling. I decided that people are chasing me, I have no pride, I'm going to scream. So I started to scream. At 10 o'clock at night, I'd never been chased by 5 men before. I'd never been chased by 5 men before. In the middle of all of this activity that was happening around me. And all of a sudden, I became very afraid. I thought, how is it that in the middle of the city, when there are people driving by, that there can be a lone pedestrian walking and all of a sudden 5 people chasing this person and there's not immediately a response? So I was attempting to to make a response. There were cars passing me as I was running up the middle of the street, and finally, I'm not a very good runner, and I was surrounded by a group of five angry men who were shouting slurs at me. And I remember one of the men, it was a pack, and one of the men had this look in his eye that was absolutely unbelievable. I've never seen anything like it in my life. It was a look that said to me, there is nothing you can say to me to prevent me from hitting you. There is nothing. I am mad at you simply because I perceive you to be a faggot. Simply because you are a man who is walking in this area of town and I'm going to beat you up. And I was very, very afraid. And I remember when this man took his arm and hit me in the head, I, being a very kind of disembodied person and a very intellectual person, I remember standing there saying, I've never been hit before in my life. I've suddenly been punched in the ear, and my ear was swelling, and this man hit me. And at that time, a car drove by as this group of five men was, this one man hit me, the group of five men was moving in, were moving in on me, and I fell to the ground, and another guy hit me, and at that time, a taxi pulled up, and the taxi driver threw open his door and yelled at the men to get away, threw open the back door, threw me into the back of the taxi, and shut the doors and locked them. And then the experience was that we were sitting in the taxi. The taxi driver did not drive away, but sat there and was turning around to see if I was okay. And the guys got around the taxi and began to shake it and to pound on the windows. And I was, the taxi driver had decided at the time that it was his little vendetta against this group of gay bashers, and so he was going to do something, and I was just wanting to get out of the area. I was saying, drive away, I don't want to be here anymore. And he had decided, well, we're going to, you know, we can't let them get away with it. I was amazed, though, at the amount of rage, at the amount of at the intensity of the expression of violence that these men had against me. I didn't know who they were, I had never talked to them, met them, I'd never seen them, I had just simply walked in front of them up the street. We finally drove away. The guys left and kind of ran up a side street, and this taxi driver decided that if he didn't do something, these guys were going to go and do something to another gay man in the area. So he phoned in and called the police. And in San Francisco, the police response is pretty immediate. The police are very good, they've been trained, and when there is a call, police respond, which is very wonderful. So we decided that we would go around looking for these guys, or he decided that he would go around looking for these guys, so that when the police came, we could direct them to this pack of bashers who were running around the neighborhood. And I recall that we drove past this park, and we were driving down the park, and we had this idea that they had gone into the park. And as we were driving down the side of the street, all of a sudden, this barrage of rocks and sticks and shouts were hurled at this taxi by these guys who were in the bushes. And I was just, I was in shock, and I was very frightened. Finally, there were four cop cars that came up and surrounded the park, and the guys got away, and we did some debriefing with the police women who attended me and the taxi driver. I share that story because I think it's significant for a couple of reasons. One, I did nothing to provoke this attack. I was simply a man in the neighborhood walking in the middle of traffic, in the middle of people, kind of in the middle of a well-lighted area to the bank. The level of rage in this man's eyes was extreme. It was irrational. It was something that was coming not from probably even acknowledged hate. It was coming from a part of him that perhaps he did not even know himself. There was nothing I could have done to dissuade him from hurting me, from beating me up. And thirdly, I think there was no interest on the part of people who drove by to help me. And there were cars that drove by as I was falling on the cement, and had it not been for this taxi driver who stopped, I don't know what would have happened. I had no ability to protect myself against five men. Needless to say, the next day I went out and got a whistle and investigated kind of self-defense classes and those types of things. But those precautions were things that I did not believe necessary prior to this incident. And the reality of violence for lesbian and gay people was not a reality that I took seriously before, really seriously before this happened to me.
I've noticed that there's been a lot of laughter as Jeff has told his story, and I want to explore that a little bit. What's the laughter about?
I know I was one of those that's laughing. I think in some ways I felt like Jeff was understating. I mean, I'm sure the intensity of his experience, but he's putting it in a very nice way. I'm sure it was not nearly as nice as the way he was explaining it. Mm. And that came across as almost the understatement of it just didn't seem to really match up with what I perceived in reality. Mm.
Have you had any similar experience, John?
I've had some physical violence years ago in high school. Mm. A lot of emotional violence, a lot of verbal violence.
Okay.
Mm.
Mm. Mm. Yes.
I don't think there's anything wrong with the laughter, because sometimes things get so heavy.
Yeah.
That we have to, if we don't have the laughter there, it would destroy us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there are many times that I have related something to someone in their presence, not what happened to me, but I get disturbed about what's happened to somebody else. But if it weren't for the fact that I say to them, I'm laughing, but it's also stupid that I can't help but laugh through the stupidity of it all.
Yeah.
And of course, I think this is what helps me.
It hurts so bad I have to laugh?
Something like that. John's.
I chuckle too, and I'm straight, and I think some of this violence is just something I think the church needs to deal with, not only gay lesbian violence, but my parents moved from Philadelphia out to Arizona recently, and I think in the past decade they have been burglarized maybe 10 times or a couple times while they lock themselves in their bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And people go through the house and take what they want, they shut out through the door and take what you want, just don't hurt us.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember when I had an inner city church as a seminarian that I chased by a gang of guys, and I don't think it perceived me to be gay, but I think they wanted my money.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, before you guys take my wallet and beat me up, can I pray with you? And the one guy says, oh my God, he's a priest. And they laughed.
Yeah.
So I suggest the next time before a guy hits you, maybe sort of make the sign of the cross or something.
I think that we can't ignore violence in our society, period. I mean, obviously, our society is becoming an increasingly violent society. But in the episodes of the burglary that you mentioned and the mugging for the wallet, there is an intent with that crime. Now, murder can also take place in the process, so it's an extremely dangerous situation, and nobody deserves to be mugged for whatever reason. But in the case of the kind of violence that we're talking about today, it's that totally objectless violence
I think all violence is, and I think that we're talking about victims, whether they be gay, lesbian, or straight, for whatever the reason, violence is violence. And I probably was picked out because I was the wrong color in that neighborhood. And I, there was no doubt in my mind they were going to not only take my wallet, but they were going to
I just wanted to pick up on a comment that John said, that kind of my story was I understated, I think, some of the reactions. I think that's very interesting. I think that's very true.
Yeah.
And I recall when I was done with this incident, when the policewoman asked me where I wanted to be let off, whether or not I wanted to be let off at home, or I had to go to the bank, so she let me off at the bank. Then I had to walk back through the neighborhood in which this incident just happened. And I didn't. I walked all the way around the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. But I got home, locked my door, got up into my room, shut my door, and I thought, now what do I do? Do I call a friend? You know, do I? And I thought, no, I can't call a friend. You know, nothing's really happened. I just have a bloody ear, and you know, but I can't. What's, you know, maybe I've been mugged a little bit, but this is. And I started to say this was not really an experience that I had had. I started to devalue, to underestimate the intensity of that experience. And I think that's a very common victim response. You know, this is not something that I can talk about with anybody. They're not going to really see the intensity of that experience. And it wasn't until I think I got back from the cruise that I told people, and they were just appalled. And I realized at that time, I think, how appalling that was.
I don't remember if I laughed or what in your story, but I related to it very strongly because it's women's experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised that up until that experience, you hadn't had to think about it very much.
Mm-hmm.
That since then, you have thought about it a lot. And as a young woman and as a mother of daughters, I have thought about it a lot, and it has happened. It comes out, it's exactly as you say, it comes out of nowhere. It comes in your mind and your own business. It is object oriented. It has nothing to do with sex in the usual way. It has to do with violence.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Situations.
Yep.
And I have to be wary when I go running in Northfield, Minnesota by myself, country road. And
John.
I think maybe just is it Don?
Right.
Yeah, to sort of, I think, tie in what Don said, I think with what Ruth was maybe starting to say, what you're talking about are really hate crimes,
right,
that are motivated,
mm-hmm,
out of hate for gay and lesbian people simply for being who they are,
right,
not for anything they did, but just for walking down the street as a gay man or a lesbian woman,
mm-hmm,
and being in that place at that time.
Yeah, and there are lots of hate crimes against women.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are, exactly. We're focusing a little more today,
yeah,
but there are clearly broader issues that interface,
right,
this.
I mean,
right,
hate,
right,
crimes are not an experience unique to lesbian and gay people,
right,
but they are crimes that lesbian and gay people experience simply because we exist, not for any other reason.
And because our society has normalized hatred towards gays and lesbians,
right,
as it has normalized as it has normalized misogyny, as it has normalized the second class status of women, you know, and the devaluation of women's bodies, that's what makes hate crimes occur, you know, and as it has normalized racism, you know.
How sympathetic has police and the court systems been to where bashings have occurred and people have been willing to prosecute? You know, what kind of experience have you had there?
Well, it depends where you are. I mean, if you're in San Francisco, the court system and the police are very responsive. But then there are openly lesbian and gay police officers. I mean, there's a great contingent on the force that are lesbian and gay people. In other parts of the United States, the police don't respond. You know, they'll laugh if you're a gay man and you've just been attacked or bashed. They don't respond. They don't send cars. They don't. If you're a gay man and you've been raped, there's no response. You know, men don't get raped. Gay men don't get raped. You know, what, as police officers, what do we have to do in this situation? There's not been a crime committed.
So there's no reported rape.
Right, and there's no violence that's happened. So it's, you know, it depends on where you live. It depends on what kind of training the police officers have gone through. I was thankful that this happened in San Francisco.
Did you want to say
anything? Well, I just wanted to... Could I tell a 2-minute story,
sure,
about the beer bottle?
Sure.
This is just I think it gets to the issue of police response. The evening of the trial, I was walking down Castro Street and discovered three high school senior men jump out of their car with liter-sized bottles of beer, drinking them, and walking behind a lesbian and gay couples, taunting them. And taunting them at a distance so that the couples didn't know that they were being followed. But they were being followed, and the guys would kind of, you know, hold the beer bottles like this above the heads or pick up rocks or something. And they never hit anybody, but they were pretending to. And I was very afraid, because these couples would be walking in a lighted part of the street, and then they would veer off, and these three men would follow them as they went into darker parts of, and I was afraid that they would get into an alley or into a part of the neighborhood that was where some kind of extreme violence could occur. So there were three of us who noticed this, and we immediately went to the phones and called the police. And within 5 minutes, there were three police cars in the Castro, again, all women officers who got out and surrounded these men and said, first of all, you're not allowed to be drinking on a public street. You have to pour out your beer. And what is it that you're doing in this neighborhood? And the guys were very defensive, and they said, well, we have a right to be in this neighborhood. You can't kick us out. You know, we haven't done anything. And the women said, well, that's fine. And for the next hour, the police cars followed these men around as they walked through the neighborhood, and until the guys got tired of being followed, and they left. And that's the type of response that's necessary. I mean, the potential for violence was very real, and it was because of the police response that nothing happened, and that those guys were taken out of that potentially dangerous situation.
I want to talk a little bit about another aspect of violence that's a bit more insidious, and that's the corrosion of self-esteem that really opens people up to being vulnerable to acts of violence against them. And I think children are always vulnerable to that outside violent oppression. And I think people of color are, and women are, and I think gays and lesbians are. And I'm reflecting on my own childhood. And I'm not sure, you know, it's hard to sift how much is what and how much is another, so I just say it that obviously I was a child, I was a girl, and I knew it and didn't know it, that I was a budding lesbian. And I grew up in a family that did not have good self-esteem, and there was lots of shame and lots of self-image, body image was just very poor, and there wasn't much that was really a resource for the goodness of being embodied and the goodness of being a female and all of that. So I didn't really have good role models for that in my family at all. And I think those things left me very vulnerable to abuse. And I was sexually abused when I was a child. I think I was about 9, maybe 10, and it was a stranger in town. He was there camping in a campground. I think he stayed a couple weeks in town. And he would play with his younger daughter in the neighborhood playground where me and my friends and brothers would play. And I was not raped, but I was sexually molested. And I didn't tell anybody for years. And I certainly did not tell my parents. And I did not tell my parents because I felt so ashamed. And I didn't really understand what had happened or why. I think most victims have a sense not only of shock, but some sense of what is my part, where is my guilt. And I think with sexual abuse, there's very much we have the taboos of clean and unclean, and it's very much a sense of how dirty, how ashamed I was. And I'm not sure how much of that had to do with my sense that I was different sexually, so that there was something about all this that I couldn't talk about anyway, so I certainly couldn't talk about this. I'm not sure how much of that was a part of it or not, but I suspect that that had something to do with my vulnerability of not knowing what to do with this. And I talk about that a little bit because I don't think that that's unusual. I think that statistics are bearing out that gay and lesbian children are sexually molested at a higher percentage than other children, that there is Well, you know some research.
I worked at Pride Institute, which is a chemical dependency treatment program for gay men and lesbians. And there, Pride is doing ongoing research with the clientele there, and it's not public. Than heterosexual boys, and that the rate of abuse for gay boys is about on a par with the rate of abuse for girls, which is, as we know, very high in this society. Because gay boys are easily marked, many of them are easily marked. Many young gay boys give evidence of their difference. They may have some effeminate mannerisms, they may have interests that don't correspond with the stereotype, the stereotypical interest that society has assigned maleness. and they already experience feeling different, just as lesbian girls experience feeling different. So it makes it all the more difficult to talk about a situation of abuse when you already feel like you don't fit in, that you are somehow unique or somehow tainted, somehow damaged goods. Shame is that experience of feeling inadequate, not being able to measure up to other people's expectations of you. It's a feeling of being so inadequate that your very self is inherently defective, inherently tainted. A quick way to distinguish between guilt and shame: guilt is a very helpful emotion, because guilt is the result of doing something that you know is wrong, where there are clear rules that you have violated and clear consequences for those rules. And guilt helps us recover. I mean, when we do something wrong that we know is wrong, that there are clear rules that we have violated, to feel guilty is an appropriate feeling, and it's a way of being able to say, I need to make amends and move on. So with guilt, it's that I made a mistake. I need to amend for that, and I need to let go, or ask forgiveness and move on. But shame is that feeling of I am a mistake. It isn't I made a mistake, it's I am a mistake. I don't deserve to be here. I don't deserve to exist. I am inherently worthless. I am inherently defective. And gay male children get the kind of ridicule from our society at a very early age. Lesbians have the culturally approved category of tomboy. Lesbians can be tomboys for several years until adolescence, when we are supposed to grow up and that's supposed to wear off and we're supposed to become ladies. But we are not as apt to be taunted for being lesbian as early an age as gay boys are taunted for being gay. However, the bad news is, I mean, that's the good news for lesbians, the bad news is we're taunted for being female. You know, and we're born into a society that devalues female. So I don't want to get into who gets the worst of it competition here, because I don't think that's very helpful. But we need to look at how oppression interfaces, how heterosexism interfaces with sexism, and how that leads to violence, that is violence.
Mm-hmm. In relation to what you were saying, as I was growing up, my father one time asked me what I wanted for my birthday, and I told him I wanted a G.I. Joe, you know, one of those little dolls. And my father said, what are you, a little panty waist over and fill your mother's breast? Later on, my mother, when I turned 16, tried to sexually abuse me. I refused to let her do it, and she threw me out on the street. I know exactly what you're talking about, and she always called me a panty waist too. So, and now my mother supposedly is very accepting of what I am and who I am. So,
it's got to be confusing for you.
It is very. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Phyllis, were you finished?
I think so. I can recount the other story.
Yeah, I think that would be helpful.
Well,
This took place in Minneapolis, where Ruth and I were living before we moved to San Francisco, and this was probably 4 or 5 years ago. And we lived in a part of Minneapolis which is a wonderful place. We lived between Lake Calhoun and Lake Harriet, and just a delightful area. And so we would often go for walks, and sometimes by the time the day would wear down, it would be later at night. And we always felt like it was a fairly safe neighborhood, and so we felt fine by just walking the neighborhood. And we would often hold hands or walk arm in arm and didn't really think much about it. And we would walk that way in the daytime too, so it wasn't just sneaking around at night. But we really didn't think too much about it. Well, and it was, there was hardly anyone around, and there would be places that would be better lit and darker. And we were having some literary discussion talking about, I don't even remember now. It was
Charles
some,
Dickens.
Yeah.
I'm telling you about a Charles Dickens novel.
so we were just talking about this, and we heard this sound in the bushes, and we thought, well, and we just kept walking and talking, and then
I think we were walking arm in arm, but we were in this intense conversation about Charles Dickens.
Yeah, we were, and suddenly this young man, looked like he was in his older teens, leaped out from behind this tree, nude. And just, and it was a cold October night. I mean, it was like, ooh. And there he was. And we just kind of.
We kept talking
about
Dickens. We
kept talking and walking. And he, this just did not do what he wanted. So he kind of ran around again and then leaped out in front of us again. And what did he say?
He said, "I know who you are.
I know what you are."
Yeah,
I know what you are.
Yeah,
and I was like, well, obviously we know what you are. I think we have more clues about you than anyone about us. I mean, it was kind of an ironic perception there.
At that point, I was really disgusted. I mean, I was really angry, but I was also determined not to kind of, you know, play into all this. And I think at that point I just turned and looked at him and said, "You know, you are really boring." And then we turned around and kept going. But while that may sound more flippant and in charge, you know, than I think I really felt. I mean, I really felt apprehensive, mm-hmm. because I wondered how many others were with him. You know, if there were others in the house that he came out of, if this was a dare on the part of his friends. I didn't know what might precipitate from it. And then it was this creepy experience of the penis as a weapon again. I mean, as a woman, I've grown up in a society that has taught me the penis is the primary weapon, you know, of males if they want to be aggressive. And that's a terrible, terrible thing to grow up with. It's not fun to grow up with that as a lesbian. It's not fun to grow up with that as a straight girl. You know, it's a terrible image to have associated with sexuality, instead of the mutuality, you know, of our relationships. And so, you know, women can talk all about the experience of you know, the penis as weapon in our society, and that's an unfortunate thing that we have in common together. And it was, you know, it was certainly an instance of that virulent homophobia that even an adolescent, I mean, as young as he was probably about 17, 18, was very much buying into. It wasn't as physically threatening to us as, it certainly wasn't the frightening kind of situation that Jeff's situation was. But it was really unpleasant. And any time I've experienced things like this, it connects with all the other instances in society that make lesbians and women feel unsafe.
Let's get Ernestine up here.
Yeah.
There seems to be a whole movement of rage. That's not something new. But it's resurfacing in extreme ways. The Aryan Nation is becoming very strong.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In Idaho, they're very open about their meetings, and the rage seems to stem from a, perhaps a sense of personal powerlessness. Mm-hmm. And we're all victims of personal powerlessness.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I'm very fearful for friends of mine who are homosexuals and very, but their mannerisms are very effeminate.
Mm-hmm.
They make themselves
mm-hmm.
potential victims of that kind of mindless crime. But when you describe the look in the eye,
mm-hmm.
you know, I've seen that look too.
Mm-hmm.
In an ethnic situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I've been terrified.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I, you know, I can
mm-hmm.
I relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I do need you to clarify what you mean by you're very concerned for people who are maybe effeminate acting because they make themselves into that situation. That in itself comes across as a
blaming the victim.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I'm responsible. For laying the onus of responsibility on the victim.
Hmm.
You know, I realize that. And I think that that's one of the terrible things about this kind of violence is that part of that violence is, like you were saying, making the person who's receiving that violence feel responsible somehow. That somehow
I can't totally.
Which
disagree.
Is something you don't want to do.
I don't
right,
want
right,
to
right,
do
that. Right,
yeah,
right,
I,
right,
you know,
right.
I can't totally disagree with you, but at the same time, there's something to be said about a person, whether they're overtly effeminate or Jeff's situation of just walking down the street. Why should a person even have to be concerned?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, to be able to walk to the bank. I know myself. I've never experienced anything. I've been fortunate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I
but
think
I'm very sheltered about myself too,
yeah.
living in the type of community I live in.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But I would hate to think that I couldn't walk down the street
mm-hmm.
without being.
You know, as a gay man, I've had to struggle with sort of the fringes of the gay community, the leather aspect and the drag queens and all of that that I don't totally identify with. But I also believe that I want, certainly in my city, Seattle to be an environment where those people can walk down the street and drag or whatever and not fear for violence.
Right.
I mean, to say that somehow we need to conform to the norm so that people don't kick us out, that to me is a real scary thought, because
right.
that then is oppression again. That's internal oppression.
Yes, it is.
I think, and so I mean, I you know, part of it is being able to be who people perceive themselves to be.
We'll get back to you, but
You know, they're telling us now whether we're or not, when you're walking down the street, you should have a deliberate walk
mm-hmm.
and so on, in order not to purge or your purge rat becoming. Look as though you're going somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You have these little things you have to do now when you're out in,
mm-hmm.
in an area that's
mm-hmm.
not safe.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody, I think, has to pick up on those little things.
And I think we all know, as women, that we can take all the precautions we know to take.
Mm-hmm.
We can walk the most authoritative way we can walk. We can walk in safe, you know, as safe areas as possible. We can do everything we know we've been trained to do to protect ourselves from rape. And it still
right.
happens,
yeah.
you know. And it's the same thing, I think, with, you know, with gay men as well. And I don't think that it's an accident that violence against gay men who may evidence effeminate, so-called effeminate behavior is particularly virulent. Because I think that the hatred of the feminine in the male
right.
is very linked to the devaluation of the feminine in society.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that
mm-hmm.
women will be safe walking down the streets of the United States until gay men are safe walking down the streets of the United States, and gay men are not going to be safe until women are safe.
Right, right. I just, oh, I,
well,
go ahead, Don.
And how do we make them safe? You know, you pass laws and you can walk with assertiveness, but in terms of as a parent with four children, how do I project values that are respectful of people with what we would call in our household alternative lifestyles that are different than ours? And the other thing is that I wonder sometimes what public education is doing to our kids, or even recess time, because, you know, I don't think that hardly a month goes by that one of our children are corrected for using the word queer or calling a brother or a sister a faggot. And so, you know, our kids have this constant exposure outside of the household. So it's really, there's a big responsibility, I think, for parents to impose values of respect for people, even if that's not the lifestyle that you chose, or even if you think that it's not correct or right, but there's a, where you engage respect for the person, and so that you don't perpetrate anything against them that you value.
That's such an excellent question.
Let's go Karen, Eric, and then I'd like to make a comment too.
Yeah, come in.
I just have a couple of observations, and I don't know any answers to your question, but I have to believe personally that all the baby steps count.
Yes.
That you do it at your own personal level in your own families, and hope that you that by your example and by some of the things that you say, it rubs off on other people, and it does begin in your home with small children. Because in our society, we're just picking up the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
All of our social programs, all the violence against people, at different kinds of levels, we are all trying to solve things after the damage has been done. And I don't know exactly how you get it back. I can give you an example in David's and my family where we've cared about these issues a lot, especially gender issues. We have girl, boy, girl. And my husband is a baseball fanatic, and when Jonathan was two, David brought home a baseball and a bat to give him. And we discovered that our oldest daughter loved to play baseball. And it had never occurred to us, and we're a family who cares about those things. And so I'm just reminded all the time about how much we are a part of the culture and how hard it is. And yet, these kinds of discussions and and all the small things do help.
Eric?
Don was mentioning earlier, like, what can we do to pass some laws? And one comment about that. there are various hate crime laws that are going on all over the country, and they're having a hard time passing. There are still people who believe that violence against gay and lesbian people is justified. In Washington, they have an amendment adding on sexual orientation on the hate crimes bill, and it hasn't passed. And some of the opponents say that, you know, the violence against gay and lesbian people is justified because they are immoral people. So even something which sounds as simple as pass a law is not that easy to do still. And that's not even addressing some of the deeper issues between the family and the home.
I think you're doing a lot, Don, if you're talking with your kids about racial epithets and sexual slurs, and talking about language and jokes, and teaching them to stand up to peer pressure and stand in solidarity. You know, because my parents taught me not to publicly ridicule other children who were different, but they didn't teach me how to stand in solidarity with them. And so I often stood by silently and helplessly. And I think that, I think that my parents have a better understanding now, you know, of how to go about that. But it sounds like you're already being quite proactive with your kids.
Well, yeah, I think inappropriate, trying to teach a child what's appropriate and what's inappropriate in terms of all aspects of their maturity. But, I support public education, but darn it, you know, the socialization aspect of public education just, you have to try to undo it at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
And I think as a church we need to look at that, because that's where we have a sense of what does it mean to claim values in community.
And I mean, that's where we can say, here's another way to have recess. Here's another way to have a classroom. Here's another way to gather together. And I think we need to do that as churches, because otherwise it is just very, you're one little island in the midst of everything else. And even as a church community, you can't be in play with everything else that's happening, but it gives you a sense of you're not just alone. And I think the community aspect of that is very important. And I think as a church, we have really written a blank check for discrimination against gays and lesbians in terms of the violence that moves toward hate crime. And in terms of, do gays and lesbians deserve safety? And we're beginning to say, well, I guess we should protect civil rights. As a church, we're saying that. But when the deeper values are, I don't know if we want you as a part of our church, you can't be here as a couple, we would never bless a holy union, I don't think we want you to have a baby and that we will baptize here, we certainly won't ordain you within our church. All of those are messages that say you don't count. Your worth isn't important. And I think as a church, we really need to look at what do our attitudes mean in terms of action? What does that really say? How do people internalize that? That we are not in a benign situation. The flow of oppression is just water running down the hills, and we see it here so forcefully, and that it takes no great genius to be oppressive. I mean, it is the flow. And so it is our actions of resistance, it is our actions of conscience that are the only things that we really have choices. It doesn't take a conscious decision for me to be racist. It's my white privilege. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to be a genius about it. I mean, I don't have to join an Aryan club to be racist. I can just go along with the norm. And I think as a church, we really need to look at that. Because I think we think it's a benign situation, and it really is not. There is so much violence that is happening. And I think, you know, I look at other kids who are 9 and 10 years old, and I don't want what happened to them, what happened to me, to happen to them. And I think it's our values. What do we teach those little kids? You count. You know, your body is important. I mean, we can do that, or we don't do that. And it's really lives that are in the balance. Mm. Will you tell Trent's story?
Okay. Before you do that, I just wanted to pick up on a comment that you mentioned, that rage seems to be on the increase. And I want to affirm that. I think that's true. And I think that as oppressed groups speak up, and as kind of lesbian and gay people come out more and become more vocal and enter the Senate and the House of Representatives and places of power, groups like the Aryan Nation will become more popular and will become more powerful. And that's very frightening. You know, I think that will escalate in the next couple of years.
Well, I want to conclude with telling you the story of John. John was a client of mine in a treatment program, and John has shared his story. That is not his correct name. John has shared his story with me and has indicated that if it's helpful to share, you know, with other people, that can happen. But I also want to give some protection to his identity. John came to treatment, a person very, very damaged by homophobia and shame. And homophobia, we've described homophobia earlier as the fear or dread of being in close quarters with a homosexual person. Well, if you are a homosexual person and you internalize homophobia, what you're internalizing is the fear and dread of being in your own body. And he certainly had that. He didn't get that out of nowhere. He grew up in a family where both of his parents were pastors. And they had bought into the cultural values which norm oppression for lesbian and gay people, that norm homophobia as justifiable and okay. And when they discovered that their own son was trying to tell them that he was gay, they had absolutely no way of responding to that positively. This was a Southern family, a very evangelical, charismatic family, and a clergy couple. And so they had John institutionalized. They had him, they tried to handle the situation sort of from a religious standpoint, and that didn't work. And so they decided to go at it from a psychiatric standpoint. And they had him committed to a psych ward, and they authorized shock treatment as a method for inducing him to forget that he was gay. And so John had shock treatment. And as he was coming out of the shock treatment, he remembers lying in bed and awakening to his father and clergy cronies of his father and other church leaders gathered around his bed, and they were doing an exorcism on him. Well, by the time that John came to treatment many years later, he was chemically addicted and extremely shameful, absolutely self-hating man. Could not find any way to live out his life as a gay man and as a Christian. And he had by that time attempted suicide several times and was very suicidal while in treatment. And his use of drugs and alcohol was a way to medicate pain and shame. It was a way to numb out feelings. While he was in treatment, our treatment center was very gay affirming. It had gays and lesbians on staff, and it was specifically for the gay and lesbian population. So all the things that were on the walls, all the artwork that was on the walls, were posters and art pieces that were very gay positive, positive models. So the whole environment was positive, and that was simply too much for John. He couldn't handle it. All his life, he had had an environment that shamed him for who he was, and to be in a positive environment set up such a dissonance within him that he just kind of flipped. And I got a phone call from the treatment center. I had gone home. I was a chaplain at the time. And they said, "Ruth, can you come back into work? John is suicidal. We're afraid he's going to harm himself. We don't want to have to transfer him to a psych ward, because that's been the place where he's been so abused." Uh-huh. And so it was really a catch-22. How do we protect him and not repeat his experience of abuse? Or the triggers for that. Well, I tried to think of, they thought maybe I should talk to him. I said, "No, it won't work. I'm a woman. John needs to hear from a man, an authority figure in society, a valued authority figure from society. He needs to hear from a clergy man. He needs to hear from someone who comes out of the authority of the church, who is straight, who represents the church in all its power." And I called the one clergy man who sort of stood for all of that in the Twin Cities, who dealt openly with lesbian and gay people and had taken lots of risks on our behalf, and he wasn't available. So I thought of my father, and I called my dad up. I said, "Well, this is a little unorthodox, but Dad, could you come in and talk with a client?" And Dad said he would. And so he came into the treatment program, and he met with John. And it wasn't a magic wand or anything, but somehow with all the authority that he conveyed and his sort of reputation in the church and his genuine piety and gift for communicating God's grace and God's love, John was touched in a way that he had never been touched before, and it was a transformative experience for him. It was a resurrection experience for him. And it was the turning point. And John was able to let go of all of the baggage that had accumulated all his life from the church. John is now sober 6 years and is doing a lot of good work in his life. He's certainly not entirely well, but he's on the road. And I guess I see that as hopeful. I hope that